Hello and welcome back to CPD Pod. I'm your host, Penny Stopforth, and today I'm delighted to have with us Deb Dana. She is a clinician and consultant specializing in helping people safely explore and resolve consequences of trauma. She is the creator of the Rhythm of Regulation training series, and she teaches internationally on the ways polyvagal theory informs clinical interactions with trauma survivors. She's also the author of The Polyvagal Theory in Therapy, Engaging the Rhythm of Regulation, which is the publication that we're going to spend some time talking about today. So welcome, Deb, and thank you so much for joining us today.
It is lovely to be here with you, Penny, and with all of your listeners.
Yes. So, Deb, perhaps we can just start. Maybe you can tell us a bit about yourself and your work, how you became interested in this topic of polyvagal theory.
Sure. So, yes, I am a passionate explorer of polyvagal theory.
Right.
And in translating Steve's theory into clinical application into everyday use. So where that all began for me, I've always been sort of a neuroscience nerd, always interested in how the brain is being impacted by therapy, since I think we therapists are working with our clients' brains and bodies. It's good to understand them. And when I read Steve's book, his original book, Polyvagal Theory, it's as if a missing piece of the puzzle came alive for me. And I understood that, although the brain is important, before the brain there is this other system, a body system, because it's really the embodied brain that we're working with, and that's where I dove into his polyvagal theory and understanding, you know, that basic concept that we talk about in polyvagal theory, that your autonomic state is the foundation for your psychological story. And so if we're going to try to create a new story, we want to work with the autonomic state. Mm-hmm. So state is the place to begin for me. And that's what I've been, writing about and teaching about since that time. And it's been a really lovely opportunity to be out in the world connecting with colleagues and creating a community of polyvagal-informed clinicians around the world. So it's lovely to be with you in South Africa today.
Yes. And so, Deb, you were saying, you know, a concept of an embodied brain, how our bodies, brains work together through our nervous system to create these stories. Could you just explain to us a little bit more about how that all works together?
I would love to. So if we think about the three organizing principles of polyvagal theory, neuroception, hierarchy, and co-regulation, that's probably the best way to begin to understand this collaboration that happens within all of our body systems, but you know, we're really talking body-brain here. So if we think first about neuroception, neuroception is the word that Steve Porges created to identify how the nervous system listens for information, takes in cues of safety and danger.
Incredible.
Because the nervous system is a subcortical system. It emerges from your brainstem. And it does have connections to limbic and cortex, but primarily it's working below the level of our awareness.
Right.
And so neuroception is the word neuro for neural and ception for awareness.
Mm-hmm.
So neuroception is this process that's happening every micro moment that we're alive. And your nervous system is listening in these three streams of awareness that I call inside, outside, and between.
Mm-hmm.
So in this moment, it's listening inside your body to what's going on in your viscera, in your digestion, in your muscles, and it's getting a sense of whether it feels safe or unsafe in there. And then it's listening outside in the environment So it's listening in the, you know, environment you're in, the very limited environment you're in, the room you're in. It's listening in the room I'm in as I'm talking with you. But then it's listening, it's expanding out to listen into the larger environment. So the space beyond my room, and then out into the world outside this structure. And then the community, and we can even think it's listening outside into the global world.
Amazing.
So neuroception is listening outside to those cues of safety and danger. And then it's listening between. So it's listening between nervous systems. You know, so even though you and I are more online together, and even not seeing each other at the moment, our nervous systems are reaching out to connect, to find a moment of meeting. And that's happening all the time, even in this online environment. So, you know, those of us who are working online want to remember, nervous systems are sending and receiving and searching for signals of safety all the time in those three streams, inside, outside, between. We call those the passive pathways. And what we really need to do is attend to those passive pathways so that we can create enough safety so that we can then work with the active pathways, which is really what we do when we're doing therapy. We're working with the active pathways. But before working with those active pathways, we have to regulate the passive pathway through neuroception. So that's one organizing principle, and we'll return to that during our podcast, I'm sure. But let's think about the second organizing principle, which really talks about this brain-body connection, is the hierarchy. And the hierarchy simply means that the way the nervous system was created over time and the way it now activates in a certain sequence. So the hierarchy gives us the order of activation of the three states of the nervous system. The earliest state to evolve in our history was what's called dorsal vagal, and it's part of our parasympathetic nervous system. And the dorsal vagal responsibility is to regulate our digestion. So it nourishes us with nutrients from our digestion. That's its everyday responsibility. It's survival's role. Its role in when it's activated into a survival state, when it becomes a survival system, is to take us out of connection into what's called conservation mode, so that everything slows down inside your body, all your system will slow down, so it's just enough energy to keep you alive, but you're in that place of collapse, disconnect, shut down, foggy, fuzzy, that sort of flavor of disappearing. That's a survival response. So that's dorsal. The next step up the hierarchy, so the next system that was created in our evolutionary history, is the sympathetic nervous system, which we probably all know is the fight or flight system.
Right.
We call it a system of mobilization. So dorsal is a system of immobilization. Sympathetic is a system of mobilization. And in its everyday responsibility, it helps regulate our breath rhythms, our heart rhythms. It gives us energy to move through the day, to move our arms and legs and head and have all that energy that keeps us moving. But does it in a regulated way. That's its everyday responsibility.
Right.
But when it's moved into its survival state, it then brings us that fight and flight, right? And when fight and flight are activated, what's called the HPA axis is also activated. That's the hypothalamus, pituitary, and adrenal axis. And when that circuit gets triggered, we're flooded with cortisol and adrenaline. So you can probably feel that sympathetic cortisol, adrenaline, mobilized, chaotic energy that happens with fight and flight in survival.
Yes.
And then we move up to the third part of the nervous system, which is the ventral vagal system. And ventral is the other part of parasympathetic. The first part is dorsal. The second part is ventral. And this ventral vagal system is the system that helps us do what we're doing today, to connect, to communicate, to move through the world with enough safety and organization to meet the demands of the day with regulation.
Right.
That's what the ventral vagal system does at the top of the hierarchy. And I believe that that's where we inherently long to be, and that our nervous system knows how to get there and knows how to be there. So, we're there. We anchor there. My word is anchor. I love that word. We anchor in ventral, and then we sometimes lose our anchor in ventral because the world brings us challenges that are too big for us to negotiate in this place of safety and organization. And because this is a hierarchy, we know the next step. When we leave ventral, we go down one step to sympathetic fight and flight.
Okay.
And if that doesn't resolve the problem, we end up at the bottom in dorsal collapse and disconnect.
Right.
You know, so this hierarchy is so useful in helping us understand our own behavior patterns, to understand what happens, and then to begin to interrupt and create some new shaping for our nervous system. And again, neuroception, when we have a neuroception of danger, it's going to activate one of these survival states, right? So they're linked together. So then the third organizing principle, just to get all three of them into our awareness, the third is co-regulation. And co-regulation simply means our nervous systems long to be in safe, regulated connection with other nervous systems. We call co-regulation a biological imperative, and that means it's something we need in order to survive. So when we enter the world, we need to be met by another nervous system and hopefully another regulated nervous system. That then sets the foundation for us to learn about safe co-regulation, to have another system that helps us regulate, helps us when we lose our anger in ventral to find the way back, to find the way, I call it home, to come home to ventral.
Lovely.
So, co-regulation is what happens before self-regulation. And we want to really think about that because nowadays in the world and even in our therapy models, we talk so much about self-regulation. And self-regulation can't nourish us unless it's built on a foundation of safe co-regulation. We can self-regulate out of survival, but it doesn't bring us the nurturance that it would if we also had safe co-regulating people in our world. So when we're working in therapy, we want to be paying attention to the ways we are the co-regulator for our clients. And it's important that we be regulated so that we can offer that regulating energy. It's important that we really bring that into awareness, these moments of safe co-regulation, because for many of our clients, people have been dangerous.
Yes.
And so co-regulation has not been an available, safe, regulating resource. So that's sort of the basic overview of the three organizing principles, and I'm going to stop there for a minute and see how they landed for you and where you want to head next.
Okay, so thank you so much, Dev, for outlining those three. I'd like to go back a bit to neuroception. I think for me that really blew my mind, just in terms of when you were describing how this is continuous process that's happening, you know, below our awareness, and that so much of that determines, as you said, what's happening within us, what's happening in the environment, and what's happening between can, I guess, have such an impact on the story or the perception of the reality that we are experiencing in that moment. So I'm thinking just in terms of being in a session with a client, we have all of this verbal exchange that's happening between us, but we have this whole other world that is coloring the entire experience, which is this principle of neuroception. You know, I suppose a lot of what we, well, certainly from my experience, you know, when you're trained as a psychologist, there's a lot of theory and cognitive processes and all of the stuff that we learn about. But I guess it sounds like there's this massive exchange that can color everything, that does color everything, that's happening between and is often overlooked.
Yes, yeah, and I love that you know, sort of reference the ways we're trained. We're trained to work, you know, to speak to brains.
Yes.
Right? We're speaking to people through brains, and yet this autonomic conversation is really going on all the time and is driving the story that we're actually then interacting with. So we want to remember that we are sending cues of warning or welcome in a constant stream to our clients. So if I have a moment when I get distracted, or if something my client is talking about touches a vulnerable place inside me, what I'm sending back to my client changes. And even though we don't name it, their nervous system hears it, feels it, and takes it in. So what we discover when we become, when we work in this polyvagal informed way is you can't fake it, right? You know, we used to think, oh, it's good enough. I can do this session even though I'm not really, regulated, or I'm not feeling well, or I really don't want to be here. You can't, because your nervous system is sending that message to anybody else in the room, right? That you're not really anchored in mental, you're not really here with them. And for many clients, that's a very familiar experience, right? The person they're with is not really there with them, right? So we reinforce their survival stories.
Right.
If we send messages that we're not fully here welcoming to them. And, you know, the other thing that happens, because I do want to say, is that we don't stay, any of us stay anchored in ventral all the time. It simply doesn't happen, nor is it the result that we're looking for, right? Mm-hmm. Really, a well-being and a life of well-being emerges when we understand the moments we get pulled away from ventral, when our neuroception is sending a cue of danger instead of a cue of safety.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And we can find our way back to anchor in ventral.
Right.
And we can notice and name that with the people who are around us. So in that statement, there are a few important concepts. One being notice and name.
Yes.
This work is about bringing the implicit experience that's going on all the time into explicit awareness and naming it with my client. So if I get distracted, I shouldn't say if, I should say when, because it happens for all of us, right? When I get distracted, I then stop and I name it and I say, your nervous system. And again, I'm having an autonomic conversation, so I often talk nervous system to nervous system.
All right.
So rather than saying, you may have noticed, saying, your nervous system may have noticed that I just got pulled into a sympathetic, distracted moment and now I'm back. I'm going to name it for my client, because for most of my clients, for most trauma survivors, that's an unfamiliar experience for somebody to actually be responsible for what is happening, right? Or to tell them, yes, what you're feeling is actually true.
Yes.
So I want to take that moment and say, what you felt did happen. And then I also want to check and see, did your nervous system send you that message?
Mm-hmm.
Because sometimes they're so mistuned that they dismiss those messages. And I want them to begin to listen to those messages again. And then the other piece of that is, but I'm back with you now.
Mm-hmm.
That's the other side to check. Can you feel that? Because sometimes clients have a hard time tuning into that autonomic connection because it's been so dangerous. So simply in talking about a moment of my neuroception getting, sending a cue of warning, there's so much clinical experience, so much clinical work that we can do just in that one small moment with that notice and name. But it takes me knowing my nervous system and being able to track it and do the notice and name. So whenever we talk about this way of working, it's really not about helping our clients get to know their nervous systems first.
Yes.
It's about us knowing ours.
Yes.
So, all my trainings and all the, work that I invite my colleagues to do is about befriending our own nervous systems first, so that we can begin to do those practices with our clients. And, it's impossible for us to do if we're disconnected from our own yes. states in our own stories that come from those yes. those states, you know. So yeah, neuroception is so powerful, yes. and because it's an implicit experience, we have to bring perception to neuroception, which is what yes. we've just been talking about. Yes. Bring perception to neuroception, bring it out of the implicit into the space between us, recognize it. Mm-hmm. And then for many clients, we have what is called a mismatched neuroception. Mm-hmm. That, you know, neuroception way back when the response was needed brought an intensity of response, but in this moment, that may not be true any longer, but neuroception hasn't updated that network yet. And so what I use with clients and with myself, even when I have a response that feels out of proportion mm-hmm. to the moment, the question that we use is, in this moment, in this place, with this person or these people, mm-hmm. is that response or that level of intensity of response needed? So that's the simple way to then begin to come into present moment and look around. And sometimes the answer is yes, still needed, great. Sure. Sometimes the answer is, it feels a little, you know, over the top for what's mm-hmm. going on in this moment. That begins to update the system, mm-hmm. right? That begins to update it. Like this morning I had a moment when it was just, you know, I had a overwhelming, one too many things coming at me. Mm-hmm. And I stopped for a moment and I did that practice. And the answer was, probably the level of intense response you're having right now is not needed, mm-hmm. right? It came from an old, something familiar from my past, got activated in that present moment and brought that intense response, right? And so as I could stop and just have a moment and sit with it and notice, oh, not really needed, then I could go underneath the response and begin to listen to the story that was driving it right. underneath there. And this morning it was a story of fear. It's usually some sort of fear that comes, that drives these. And I could just spend a moment listening and then my system came within a more regulated range so that I could do something with it, right? So it's a fascinating process to begin to, you know, bring neuroception into perception and then work with it. So yeah.
I mean, I really loved what you were saying just about how the point is not to be in ventral all the time. The point is to notice and name wherever you find yourself. Because I guess if I think about different clients or even different moments with the same client in one session, our nervous systems are communicating in different ways all the time. And for me as a therapist, being opposite a particular flavor of nervous system or a nervous system that's in a particular state is going to be evocative for me too because of my own history and the way that my own nervous system has been shaped. So it really is quite a dynamic, ever moving, ever changing process where the aim is to track what's happening between rather than force into this Zen state all the time. Which I think is non-shaming way of working with what comes up. A lot of the language that you've used, even the word biological imperative for the experience of longing for another nervous system, even befriending the nervous system, all of that language is so non-shaming when we talk about what's happening nervous system to nervous system.
Yes, I love what you just said, bringing it really into focus in that way. This is a very non-shaming way of working. I have clients all the time who say, oh, it's such a relief to know that, you know, it's my biology.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we want to, as we look, you know, at our own systems, but as we look across at another person, you know, rather than making up a story or assigning motivation, or even moral meaning, which we do so often, mm-hmm. to look across and say, oh, that system is, they have a dysregulated nervous system right now,
wow.
which is bringing that behavior or that belief or that way of moving through the world alive for them.
Yeah.
You know, which, you know, if we can think for a moment about the hierarchy.
Yes.
You know, we see the different stories that are possible from the different states, because from sympathetic, you know, I have moved away from social connection because social connection is not going to help my survival. And so the stories that emerge there are ones that, you know, people are dangerous, the world's dangerous, and I have to act to protect myself,
yes.
Right? So that's that place of fight and flight. So the stories, when I'm unsympathetic, the story can never be one that, oh, you're a safe and caring friend for me to talk with. It's not that I don't want that, but my biology doesn't support that.
Yes.
And when you begin to look at it that way, it's relieving for all of us to think, oh, it's not that I'm choosing to be this way. It's that my state, you know, won't support me in doing something different right now, because that then it leads us back again to, so rather than changing the way I'm thinking or beating myself up for this, I'm going to work with my state.
Right.
Because if my state regulates, I find my way back home to ventral, then I have the option to connect and communicate and problem solve, and, you know, all of those options appear. There are lots of stories in that place of ventral, whereas in sympathetic, the stories are limited. And then in dorsal, just to not forget that, you know, that place, which, you know, is a place of disappearing, you know, in when I go to that place, you know, people don't really even exist. I'm sort of floating, you know, around the world, the people are sort of out of focus.
Right.
I'm in my own little space floating, and so it's a terrifying place for we humans to be. And my clients would often tell me, so I use this quote because so many of them told me that they felt lost, abandoned, alone, where no one would ever find them.
Wow.
And you can feel the intensity of that when you hear those words, right? That's the dorsal experience.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the story in dorsal is one of despair and hopelessness.
Mm-hmm.
So if your client is in dorsal and you want them to, you know, create an action plan to do something different in the world, you know, we have to look and say, they can't possibly do that because their nervous system can't support them in doing that. We have to help them find their way through a bit of mobilizing energy to bring some energy back into their system, and then to that place of ventral regulation where they then could consider, what might I do to find my way back here again?
Mm-hmm.
And I like what you said about not always being in ventral, but the experience our clients have is that they get pulled into sympathetic or dorsal survival and get stuck there.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So the problem isn't that they get pulled into survival. The problem is that they get stuck there and keep coming back.
Mm-hmm.
So our job is to, you know, help them, you know, reconnect to those pathways, because they do exist inside them already. Reconnect and then travel them over and over and over, so that, you know, they don't get lost. They don't get stuck.
Right. Deb, the one thing that I found really helpful is the visual of the maps and the exercises that you put together in the book. And I wonder if you could maybe just talk through the ladder, where the ladder fits in.
Absolutely. Sure. Yeah, so, you know, when I first read Steve's work and it made so much sense to me, I then thought, well, what do I do with this to create a visual and create a map? Would we humans love maps?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
You know,
particularly when
you're
lost.
Exactly. And, you know, we're lost so often, right? And, you know, you think about your clients who come to therapy. They don't come to you in therapy because they, you know where they're going. They come to you because they're lost, or they want to go in a different direction and don't know how to do that. So a map seemed to be exactly where to go. And then it was, for me, what represents the hierarchy, because it really is this hierarchy that we're wanting our clients to understand and work with. And so a ladder was the natural choice for me, because on a ladder we move, you know, up and down and up again in small steps. We go rung to rung, which really is the case with the nervous system. We don't simply go from ventral to all of a sudden we're in sympathetic and then all of a sudden we're in dorsal. There's progression that happens there. And there are flavors of all those states. So the rungs could for me, you know, depict the flavors and the progression. Dorsal, I put at the bottom because it is that place of of feeling. You are still on the ladder, which I want people to recognize. I was doing training a long time ago with a bunch of first responders, and one of them said, "Oh, I love the fact that even when I'm in dorsal, I'm still on the ladder." So wonderful. Yes, you're always on this ladder. Something you never lose the ladder. So you know, dorsal at the bottom, and then sympathetic in the middle, and ventral at the top. So at the top of the ladder, you know, you have this lovely view. You have perspective. You can see for miles. You know, it's a place of freedom and possibility. And then when you begin to feel danger coming, you move down the ladder a bit. And sympathetic, and there are less options there, right? The world closes in a bit. We become more single focused. There aren't as many stories. And then if that doesn't resolve the challenge and we don't climb back up to ventral, we then move down to the bottom to dorsal. And you can just imagine as you're down in dorsal and you're looking up to the top of ventral, how you can feel that despair. How do I ever get back there? It can feel overwhelming.
Yes.
And yeah, so, you know, the ladder's divided, and then we have these questions that we begin to befriend our nervous system in each of those states to discover, how does that state come alive for me? There are some, you know, basic operating principles of each state. And so if you're a ladder, if you did a ladder and I did a ladder, they would look very similar in the themes, and yet the particular experiences are unique to our own lives. So, and you know, we each have a home in ventral, and we have what I call a home away from home, because our system has been shaped by our experience, and we visit both sympathetic and dorsal. But I think we have a profile that we lean more towards one than the other. Okay. So my home away from home is dorsal.
Right.
I go through sympathetic to get there, but I joke with people. I say, I think I take the express elevator. I don't spend a lot of time in sympathetic. Dorsal is really my go-to because if you disconnect, I can go through the motions without really being here, without really, you know, focusing on it. That for me is home away from home. And what's yours? If you think about your system, are you more of a sympathetic, energized fight flight, or a dorsal?
I think I can relate to both, but what I would say my first language, if I can put it that way, would be probably sympathetic. If I've been in sympathetic for too long, without any dipping my toe in any ventral, then I will have that feeling of just kind of wanting to curl up and assume the fetal position and wait for the waves to pass.
Exactly. Yes. And see, what a lovely description of the sequence that your nervous system takes. I like your first language. It's probably your first language, you know. It's your go-to survival state.
Yes.
And when you don't get to dip a toe in ventral, and I use that language as well. I think dipping a toe is what we do. Just keep dipping the toe. And when you don't get to do that, dorsal's going to sort of come to the rescue and get you out of that overwhelming, intense sympathetic charge, because, you know, we can't stay there forever.
Absolutely.
Right? And so dorsal comes to the rescue until you can begin that, you know, re-engagement with the world again. So, yeah, that's a beautiful, beautiful description of what happens. And you probably can think of your clients. And you can find clients who have that sequence that you have, and you can have clients that have the sequence that I have.
Yes.
You know? Yeah. But just being able to put it on a map, and having clients be able to put it on
Absolutely.
A map is empowering. Yeah.
You know, part of what you've said is there are themes that are similar, but I suppose there's kind of unique expressions, or maybe unique fears or sentences or thoughts that fits each individual client. So I think it's a wonderful journey to be able to take together to discover what dorsal means for each person and what it brings out. It's almost like a parallel process of co-regulating, you know, learning to speak the same language about your client's process. I think is an amazing tool to be able to reach for the world is kind of biased to talking brain to brain. So I'm so appreciative of tools that can help explain unconscious nervous system processes that can put words and have outlines to an otherwise maybe quite foggy concept, if I can put it that way.
Yeah, and I love what you said about, you know, your, you know, a journey together. It's really, this is the polyvagal approach, is that everything is we're doing it together.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm with you. We're in this together. I often tell my clients we're going on an autonomic journey, and we're going together, right? And the other thing I often say is, not sure where we're going, because when you're in an autonomic conversation, we don't really know. We're going to go wherever our client's nervous system lets us know we need to go. So I tell my clients, you know, we're going together and we're taking ventral with us. Because as long as we take ventral with us, it's safe to go, right? And again, that's the experience clients don't have. They weren't able to take ventral with them to these, you know, survival places. And so, you know, oftentimes it's my ventral that we're taking with us, and that's my commitment to my clients. But we're also going to have them dip a toe in their own ventral along the way, and you know, what does that feel like when, instead of simply being in that overwhelming sympathetic fight energy, you know, you're not there alone first, which is a very different experience for them. Somebody's here with you. Somebody regulated is here with you, just with you. And what does it feel like to have a drop or two of that ventral here too? It's powerful when it begins to change the experience.
So I guess part of what you're reflecting on is understanding how the nervous system has previously been shaped and how that color interactions with others and other nervous systems. But you're also talking about the hopefulness that it can also be reshaped as co-regulation occurs. That, as you were talking about earlier, that we learn to self-regulate from these safe places of co-regulation first. So it's a really a hopeful message, the message of reshaping together.
Yes, and I tell my clients that, and I teach that, you know, polyvagal theory is a hopeful theory because it does tell us that we can reshape these autonomic response patterns, right? Where they're not set in stone, you know, just like when we discovered neuroplasticity and that the brain can reorganize and rewire, the same is true for the nervous system. And so these, you know, habitual response patterns can be reduced, can be resolved, can be reshaped. And as they reshape, that information then gets fed up to the brain and the brain restories, right? So that's the process that I like to take my clients through. We reshape and then we restory. And then we go back and reshape a bit again and then we restory. So it's this back and forth that keeps happening. Yeah, it's a gentle pathway, which again, I appreciate,
And Deb, maybe could you just speak a bit to how this complements or is mirrored in attachment theory? Because I guess a lot of what, when you're speaking about co-regulation, it starts to sort of bring up
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we go back to what we said. We come into the world wired for connection.
Mm-hmm.
We're hoping to be met by a regulated nervous system. And, you know, for so many people, that's not true. You know, for many of us, for most of our clients, either the nervous system that met us, the caring other, whoever that was in our world, you know, was unpredictably regulated or, you know, not predictably present in a regulated way all the time, or was dysregulated in a way that was dangerous for us. Or sometimes I also think there's simply a mismatch that the, you know, my nervous system might have needed somebody who was regulated in a certain way, and yeah. I got someone who was regulated in a different way, mm-hmm. not necessarily dysregulated, but just couldn't meet me in the way I needed. Mm-hmm. So there are lots of ways that the nervous system is looking for attunement, for a mm-hmm. match, and doesn't get that. Mm-hmm. And when that doesn't happen, you know, we then move into these attachment categories that you know, we're all probably familiar mm-hmm. with. But the thing I'd like to say again, another hopeful thing that we know through Ed Tronick's brilliant work, is that match, that attunement, that, you know, regulated system meeting mind only has to happen about 30% of the time.
Unbelievable.
But the other 70% of the time, caring other, the caring adult, needs to recognize there has been a rupture mm-hmm. and needs to make a repair.
Okay.
And so that for the little ones who come into the world and, you know, they get that 30% match and they get a parent or a caregiver who recognizes the ruptures and makes the repair, they will likely end up with that secure attachment and move through the world in that way because they got what they needed, right? For the little ones who come into the world and they only get the 30%, you know, match, 30% attunement, and don't get the repair, then we see these other attachment categories, right? We see the insecure or the disorganized attachment categories. And, you know, we can think, how do they map with the nervous system? And it's interesting to begin to look at that, a nervous system that's biased more towards a sympathetic survival response. Mm-hmm. You know, which attachment category might that connect with? And, you know, it's that anxious ambivalent that is fueled by need. Mm-hmm. I have to figure out what's mm-hmm. going on over there in order to feel safe. I can't depend on me, so I have to look for you mm-hmm. to do that, might be. And then that more avoidant category of, you know, might be more of the dorsal disconnect, right? Mm-hmm. I can't depend on you. I have to depend on me. That's sort of going through the world on my own place, right? And then if you think about the dysregulated, the disorganized category, for me, that really is a nervous system that loops between sympathetic and dorsal, right? There's a needy reach out, reach out, reach out, reach out, and then there's a pull back, pull away. Yeah, so, you know, if we think about nervous system when we're looking at a client's attachment category or belief system, we can probably go underneath any of those and find the autonomic mm-hmm. foundation that those emerge from, which is a fascinating way to do it, right?
Yes, I'm thinking of attachment theory, that's the brain language mm-hmm. that we can put to the processes that you're talking about. The words like attunement, for example.
Right. You know, because we talk about this in therapy all the time. We talk about therapeutic alliance, we talk about attunement, we talk about this. But when you think about it through the lens of the nervous system, you can operationalize it. You understand mm-hmm. what it is you're saying, right? Attunement is my nervous system being anchored and ventral, offering those cues of safety to my client's nervous system so that they can receive them and find their way to ventral as well, right? That's attunement.
Absolutely. Right? And that, you know, in the same way we think about the stranger experiment, and the image that always sticks with me is the avoidant attachment style where the child on the outside looks like she's just ignoring what's mm-hmm. happening, but the readings about levels of anxiety and stress is even mm-hmm. higher than in the anxious little one. And so for me, I think that's such a powerful picture of I almost want to say the real conversation mm-hmm. that's happening mm-hmm. in the room, and how that conversation, how that way of relating or experiences with the other shapes how alert or how available or whatever the nervous system needs in order to keep that proximity to the person that they are dependent on, and that carries through with us into our relationships. later.
Absolutely. Yeah, because what, you know, we create, you know, what I think Steve would call neural expectations.
Wow.
Our automaton creates expectations about what's going to happen in a relationship. Mm-hmm. Our brain makes up the story, but our nervous system creates those pathways, those expectations, and then, you know, they get played out because my nervous system begins to take me in that direction because that's been the experience.
Absolutely.
And yes, I love what you're talking about. We're really having this other conversation. We're tuning into the autonomic creation so that we can begin to engage there, you know, rather than on the brain level, which is the brain's job, if we think about it.
Right.
The brain's job is to make sense of what's happening in the body, right?
Yes.
80% of the information from your system is coming from the body to your brain. 80%.
It's just as
And so 20% is the brain taking that information and figuring out how to make some sense of it and coming up with a story, right? Mm-hmm. And boy, the brain can make some very interesting stories, right?
Super creative. Super creative.
You're super creative. Exactly. You know, if you think, I was working with somebody the other day and she said, I've just figured out that when my heart starts pounding, it's not necessarily panic. It could also be excitement, right? It's the same biological response, but the brain now no longer has to simply say panic. It now takes a moment and says, oh, there are a couple choices here, right? Because she has more access to ventral depth.
Yes. So that top part of the ladder where there are more options, where you can see, have a better view, changes everything.
Yeah. And she's worked really hard to be able to, you know, have a hand reaching up to that part of the ladder, even though she still feels fairly, you know, solidly anchored in her sympathetic. She has a hand that can reach up now, which is sort of our imagery that we use with this particular person. Her hand is now reaching up and grabbing a rung of ventral. And when she does that, you know, she then all of a sudden it's not simply panic, which is so fascinating.
Exactly. And now that we're on the topic of ventral, are there any kind of practices or any kind of places that you would, you know, recommend to clients to sort of cultivate what it might feel like to dip a toe or pop into for those who haven't, you know, really had a lot of time in that part of their nervous system?
Right. That's a lovely way to put it. Haven't spent a lot of time there. And as they begin to experiment with spending some time there, in the beginning it feels very unfamiliar.
Yes.
And can feel like a cue of danger. So we just want to, you know, note that. We want to say that out loud. And I say that to my clients. I had a client who said, you know, this is too weird. I can't stay in this place. And I said, of course not yet. Because your nervous system doesn't have a lot of experience there. So we're just going to keep dipping in and dipping in and dipping in until it feels safer there. So, you know, I guess what I would love to leave you with as a practice would be this practice that I call ventral vagal anchors that I really do love. And so I'll take you through it just for a moment. It's the who, what, where, when of your ventral. And so we start with a who, and my invitation is for people to think of a person who, when you're around them, you feel that welcome. You feel those cues of safety and the welcome. And for many of our clients, in the beginning, they may not find a who in their world. We may be the who for our client. Hopefully in our, you know, connections with our clients, we are a who that offer that ventral regulation and that welcome. Pets are often my clients' first who. Their dogs, their cats, their horses. The other day it was somebody's cow. I loved it, you know. So, you know, a pet or me or a person, you know. And so that's a who. So find a who. And in the beginning it's just one who, and then we'll keep adding to the list as we find more of these regulated systems who surround us. And then a what, you know, what's a very simple thing you do that brings you a micro moment of feeling that regulation or feeling that welcome. You know, and for me, the what is often looking out a window at nature, mm-hmm. right? Because nature is pretty predictably activating of ventral, the research tells us.
Yes.
But what is a thing, you know? And it can be looking at, I have clients who have a certain photograph that they look at,
mm-hmm.
or have a certain color that they bring to mind. It's something very simple.
Mm-hmm.
These anchors are simple micro moment practices, mm-hmm. not a great deal. Because in the beginning we need a micro moment. So we had a who and a what. Where is a place in the world where you feel safe and regulated and welcome, right? And where is an interesting thing to explore with your clients? Sometimes back when we were in offices, and where most of us are not in our offices mm-hmm. now, but our offices were often aware for a client. Again, a place in nature can be aware. I was talking the other day with a colleague who shared with me that her client couldn't find aware. And, you know, they said, it's okay, you know, we'll discover one along the way. He came back the next week and he told her he had created a where in a corner of his house.
Oh, isn't that amazing?
Just lovely, right? So a where can just be a tiny little place mm-hmm. where you go, you put yourself in that place and it feels, oh, ventral, yes. And you just dip a toe in. Literally, you can dip a toe into that. And then the when, you know, when are the times when you just feel that ventral mm-hmm. welcome? And it can be time of day. I'm a very early morning person, so that early morning moment when before the world wakes up is what I call mm-hmm. it, is a when for me. Other people are night owls, mm-hmm. right? Some people, there's certain days of the week that for some reason bring them that, or they're a certain time when they're with another person. So look for the when. And then you have one thing at least, and with my clients, I just start with one. One who, one what, one where, one when. And we write them down, you know, because part of this process is about being very concrete
mm-hmm.
and explicit, because when we need an anchor, is not the time to be looking for one. It's the time
right.
to be grabbing a piece of
reaching
paper
for one.
That says, here, right, yeah, pre-plan.
Exactly.
So then, you know, we have these anchors on paper, yeah. and you put them somewhere where you know where they are. I have some clients who are incredibly artistic, and they create these lovely illustrations mm-hmm. of their anchors. And then I have four bullet points, right? So it can run the range of how you want to. Yeah. So, you know, but there's somewhere where you can grab them. I talk to my clients, let's grab an anchor. Right, so you have that piece of paper and you can look at it, because you have enough capacity to read those anchors, but you don't have enough capacity to go,
to
you know, create them on your own in that moment.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah,
wow.
create your ventral vagal anchors and see what happens there. Yeah.
And the other one I was thinking about, I remembered you mentioned, was music.
Yes, music is like, so amazing.
But
yeah, and music, you know, there's a lot of research on music
yes.
and the impact of music to our mm-hmm. nervous system and then to our stories. And what I do with my clients, and this is a very easy one to do because music's all around us. There's
yes.
so many ways to connect with music, and it's a lovely sort of more passive regulating activity.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Created your
exactly.
music, you push a button, right? Which is what we need. But create playlists.
Yes.
And, you know, I often have my clients create a simple ventral vagal playlist.
Mm-hmm.
These are the songs that really help you really feel and deepen into your ventral. And then I also have them create playlists that have ventral, sympathetic, and dorsal songs,
mm-hmm.
music. So that they can travel the hierarchy through music.
Right.
Because the research tells us that music has a paradoxical effect for us, that we can be with sympathetic survival in a way that is actually enjoyable, and we can be with safely through music.
That's
the same
amazing.
Is true as dorsal.
Mm-hmm.
So,
wow.
Yeah, I can go to my dorsal and actually sort of enjoy it because,
yeah.
first of all, I'm not alone because I'm with music.
Yes.
It's a feeling of not being alone.
Yeah.
And there's something in the music that resonates with my dorsal state. Yeah. And then sooner or later, you know, I'm going to then, you know, the next song's going to come, and hopefully the next song's going to take me somewhere else on my ladder. Right. So mix the songs up so that you never know kind of what's coming, because that helps them build the flexibility into your nervous system. Yeah. So yeah, music, yeah.
So often the difficulty is around being stuck in a space rather than being flexible and moving in between. And I guess there are times where if you're able to know where you are on the ladder, that you can honor that.
But your language is so polyvagal inspired, because that's exactly what we do. We honor it.
Yeah.
We honor the adaptive survival response. And whenever we say survival response, we want to put the word adaptive in front of it, because the nervous system has been intuited or neurocepted a danger and has taken us into this survival response in service of our survival.
Right.
So it's an adaptive survival response that we then want to begin to reshape the neuroception so that we can reshape the pathways. Yeah.
And I mean, maybe just in terms of a kind of a final thought in terms of application, the one thing that's been a lot on psychologists' minds in South Africa at the moment is moving over to doing therapy online, which I find my nervous system feels like it has to work extra hard on.
Yeah.
It's a really different feeling having somebody in the room. I mean, it's such a good example of how amazing that neuroception network really is, that sometimes it's more difficult to get a sense of the person. I suppose we get these like truncated views. And so maybe you can just talk to, you know, how you've adapted or held the nervous system in the conversation in this very different therapy climate.
Absolutely. Yeah. It is a different therapy climate. And I actually just finished writing a piece for the Psychotherapy Network about telehealth and polyvagal and our nervous systems. And so it's dear to my heart at the moment. And, you know, one of the things that it's brought up for many of my colleagues is the importance of having this shared language, of having our clients understand where they are, what their nervous system is doing at the moment. So I would encourage people to you know, begin to do that mapping with their clients, because it's easy for me to ask my client, well, where are you on your ladder right now? Because I don't get all the cues that I used to get when we were sitting together in a room. So I can simply ask, and their nervous system will give us the answer, which is helpful. But the other thing that I, you know, really think we want to consider is, you know, we set up our virtual space, and we want to invite our clients to let us know what in my virtual space is acute safety for you and what might be acute danger, right? Because many of us are now doing therapy from a different space than our office. For people who are lucky enough to do their virtual work still from their office, that's been a predictable context for their clients. Most of us have created a new space. And on the other end, our clients are in different spaces all the time.
Absolutely.
Right? And so, you know, we have to help them find safety in their space so that we can then enter into this moment of meeting together. And I, again, it's in the, how close do I sit through the screen?
Yes.
How far away? How loud or soft do I talk? Mm-hmm. All of these things, you know, even this way of where the heck am I looking so that I look like I'm looking at my clients, right? You know, but these are the things you bring into explicit awareness and experiment with, so that the client's nervous system can give you the information you need. I have some clients that want me to sit very close, and other clients who love it when I sit back, right? And, you know, clients sometimes want to turn off their video because it's too much and have audio only. Sometimes they want me to turn off my video. It's a lovely sort of thing we can do to play that we couldn't do in our office in the same way. And I also want to say that for many clients, I'm hearing from colleagues that many clients are finding there is something that feels very safe about this way of working, and they are doing deeper work than they were doing in the office. That there's a moment when the world feels they're buffered enough from the world that they are beginning to do some of the work that has been waiting for them and they weren't able to do. So, you know, to encourage, you know, all of our, you know, colleagues to, you know, create the safety. And then for some of us, it's been going back to basics for clients, which has been absolutely helpful.
Yes.
Because it's strengthening that foundation. And then for others, clients, it's been, oh, there's this piece of work that all of a sudden they're ready to do. How fascinating. Wow. Let's do it. So, you know, yes. The whole range is
absolutely
happening even as well. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's in some ways there's a real opportunity, particularly around, I suppose, if you're thinking about environment and neuroception, that maybe for some in their home, in their sacred space, maybe their animals are nearby, maybe in some way that is more comforting for their nervous system.
Yeah.
And,
exactly.
But for others, a sense of difficulty around not being able to get as much information, maybe more activating of dysregulated systems.
Yes.
So I suppose going back to the point of how each nervous system is unique and really working to make things explicit together.
I'm so happy you brought that up because this is this sense of this is an ongoing autonomic conversation. This is not a one and done conversation.
Yes.
It's not like, oh, we figured it out, so, you know, next week is going to be the same.
Right.
It can change week to week. It can change within a session.
Absolutely.
Right? And
absolutely.
that's the commitment to stay in that conversation is what I have with my clients. Right? I'm going to stay in this conversation with you. We're going to keep checking in and we're going to find what your system needs to have enough safety in this moment and then in the next and the next and the next. So, yeah. And it changes all the time, which is the beauty of the nervous system. It's always responding to the cues it's receiving.
Yes. And as you said, it's always somewhere on the ladder. It's always working. It doesn't check out.
It does not.
Always available. You know, to be honored.
Ventral's always there. We sometimes lose, you know, connection to it. I had a client who told me she thought, you know, she didn't have that part of her nervous system. And I said, well, you're alive. And so we know you do. And it's there. We just have to, you know, find a way to have your pathways there be uncovered. You know, rather than saying, oh, we got to do this whole new thing. I love to tell my clients, it's there. We're just going to uncover the pathways and then travel them together. So it's a very, you know, it's non-shaming, non-blaming, and feels very joining.
Yes.
Right?
And I really like that you've reflected in any session, it can be at different points on the ladder. And if I'm thinking of back to what you were saying about attachment, that a lot of the therapy journey is going to involve these misattunements, but where it's different is that we can communicate and validate that there was, in fact, a misattunement that did happen. Your nervous system was correct. There was something, and let's work out how to repair this and get on the same page is where the sort of magic happens. So not really in these perfect Zen therapy. It's in this, maybe just as important, if not more important, is those moments of misattunement that can be repaired.
Yes, it's the you know, letting our clients and, you know, people we live with, love, and work with, everybody know this is the natural flow of our relationship. It's the natural flow, and we don't want to avoid it or ignore it. We want to embrace it. We want to create a practice of noticing the ruptures and making repairs.
Yeah.
That's what strengthens a relationship, deepens a relationship. So yeah, that's what we're looking for.
Yeah.
And it happens all the time in a therapy session. We have these micro moments of rupture. You know, we know when the big ruptures happen because you can't avoid them.
Yes.
And then you figure that, right? I mean, I've had plenty of those in my therapy experience, but what we're talking about in this really is these mini moments and to really honor those and notice and name them, because then we're creating this practice of noticing, naming, making a repair, and clients' nervous systems will wish you burn on that.
Amazing. Deb, thank you so much. I mean, I think we've taken a very kind of vast scope across this wonderful polyvagal theory way of working, and I'm just so grateful for all that you've shared, just from the basic principles, but really what it looks like in application. I think that's what was just so amazing for me about your book is this kind of translating an accessible way to start to understand this really critical conversation that is happening in the room that often maybe gets missed or overlooked. So if our listeners want to learn more about some of the work that you're doing, or where can they find more information?
So if you go to my website, which is rhythmofregulation.com, probably most everything is posted there, and you can find, you know, a bunch of interviews and things like that, the books, all that sort of stuff there. So yeah, dive in, please.
Yes, sounds amazing. Wonderful, Deb. Thank you so, so much for joining us today. We so appreciate your time.
It's been lovely. Thanks for having me.